From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We've been keeping up with the events of the war through the work of journalists who have been risking their lives. Some have died in Iraq. On today's Fresh Air, we pay tribute to war correspondents by talking about one of the greatest, Ernie Pyle. He covered World War II and died in the Pacific. We'll talk with James Tobin, author of Ernie Pyle's War. It won a National Book Critics Award after it was first published in 1997. Tobin writes, Pyle had become far more than an ordinary reporter, more even than the most popular journalist of his generation. He was America's eyewitness to the 20th century's supreme ordeal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. troops moved into central Baghdad today, entering two of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's palaces. A U.S. brigade commander says U.S. forces are establishing a mobile command center at one of the compounds. Other troops are seeking out pockets of resistance. The BBC's Raghi Omar describes some of the fighting in the Iraqi capital.
Baghdad has always been the main prize in this war. Today, we witnessed American forces fight in the heart of this city. Mortars pounded Iraqi positions as they moved into a central presidential compound. American armored personnel carriers didn't even bother to move from the main boulevard. Iraqis were caught by surprise. Stunned and terrified, they fled in whatever they were wearing.
The BBC's Raghi Omar in Baghdad. Pentagon officials say further tests will be conducted on material found in a compound south of Baghdad to see whether it could be chemical weapons agents. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld would not confirm or deny reports that chemical weapons were found.
We don't do first reports, and we don't speculate, and I can tell you it takes days to get samples of things from wherever they are in the battlefield into a first place where they take a look, and then to a second place where things get checked. And I think that the prudent thing in a case like this would be to let the thing play itself out, and we'll see what's, we'll eventually know.
U.S. military officers at the scene in Iraq said some tests of the material were inconclusive, but some suggested the presence of nerve agents. They said it was possible some of the material could be agricultural pesticides. President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair have begun another summit. They're meeting in Belfast, Northern Ireland, to discuss the post-war reconstruction of Iraq. Earlier today, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan stressed that his organization must have a role in rebuilding Iraq if the process is to be credible.
The UN involvement does bring legitimacy, which is necessary for the country, for the region, and for the peoples around the world.
UN Chief Kofi Annan. U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte said he believed that there will be a role for the UN, but that people shouldn't be surprised if the U.S. and its allies took the lead in Iraq because they made the sacrifices to oust Saddam Hussein. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 23 points to close at 8,300 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 6 points. It closed at 1,389. This is NPR News. Police in Oakland, California, fired what they described as non-lethal weapons at anti-war protesters blocking the city's port. 6 protesters and 6 dock workers were hurt. Reporter Carrie Kahn later met some of the protesters.
I saw a couple protesters that had been hit by wooden dowels. They're about an inch in diameter, hard wooden dowels. They had created a bunch of welts on a few of the protesters' backs. The protesters say they were retreating at the time and the injuries were in their back. The police officers also said they used stinger ball grenades that are filled with little rubber BBs. They shot those into the crowd and then they exploded and caused a little bit of a panic among the protesters.
Carrie Kahn of member station KQED. Police said they opened fire only after the demonstrators attacked them with rocks and bolts. Winners of the Pulitzer Prizes for Journalism, Letters, and Music were announced today in New York. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
The Boston Globe was recognized for what the Pulitzer Committee called courageous, comprehensive coverage of the Catholic sex abuse scandal. The Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post won 3 Pulitzers each. Writer Jeffrey Eugenides took the fiction Pulitzer for his novel Middlesex, and composer John Adams won for his work on the transmigration of souls. In general nonfiction, Samantha Powers won for her study of 20th century genocide, called A Problem from Hell, and Robert A. Caro was recognized for the 3rd volume of his biography of Lyndon Johnson. It is Caro's 2nd Pulitzer for biography. Each prize is worth $7,500, except for the Public Service Award. Newspapers winning in that category receive a gold medal. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
And I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from members of the NPR Legacy Society, helping to guarantee NPR's financial future by including NPR in their estate plans, npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've been getting unprecedented media coverage of the war in Iraq from journalists who are risking their lives. 2 American journalists have died covering the war, Michael Kelly and David Bloom. Today we talk about war correspondents by focusing on the life and death of Ernie Pyle. He's widely acknowledged as the finest World War II correspondent and perhaps the best war correspondent in history. He was killed in combat in the Pacific shortly before the Allied victory in Europe. My guest James Tobin is the author of the book Ernie Pyle's War. Tobin writes, Pyle was America's eyewitness to the 20th century's supreme ordeal. His published version of World War II had become the nation's version. America's mental picture of the soldiers who had won it was largely Pyle's creation. He and his grimy GIs, frightened but enduring, had become the heroic symbols that the soldiers and their children would remember as the good war. The biography Ernie Pyle's War won a National Book Critics Circle Award after it was first published in 1997. It's still available in paperback. James Tobin also has a new book called To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers and the Great Race for Flight. I asked James Tobin to start by reading one of the Ernie Pyle columns excerpted in the biography.
This is Ernie Pyle writing in a column from Tunisia in early 1943. The men are walking. They don't slouch. It is the terrible deliberation of each step that spells out their appalling tiredness. Their faces are black and unshaven. They are young men, but the grime and whiskers and exhaustion make them look middle-aged. In their eyes as they pass is not hatred, not excitement, not despair, not the tonic of their victory. There is just the simple expression of being here as though they had been here, doing this forever and nothing else. The line moves on, but it never ends. All afternoon, men keep coming round the hill and vanishing eventually over the horizon. It is one long, tired line of ant-like men. There is an agony in your heart, and you feel almost ashamed to look at them. They are just guys from Broadway and Main Street, but you wouldn't remember them. They are too far away now. They are too tired. Their world can never be known to you.
That's a chilling last sentence. Their world can never be known to you. How much did Pyle try to describe the more horrible aspects of that war? How much did he want to share that with the readers, and what did he want to protect them from?
I think he wanted to share as much of it as he thought the public could tolerate, as much as sort of was within the bounds of good taste as it was defined in the 1940s. He wanted to communicate the reality of war, and to a certain extent described certainly death, terrible injuries, battle fatigue. But sometimes when he tried to describe the gorier details, his content would be censored. There was a certain reticence on the part of the military and on the part of the war correspondents about describing too much of the really worst realities of war. In a certain sense, too, Ernie is saying here, as he said often, not just that I don't want to describe the realities to you, but there is a fundamental difficulty in telling someone who hasn't been through war what war is really like.
What was the style of Ernie Pyle's war reporting? What was different about his reporting than the other correspondents of World War II?
Ernie wrote in the first person, for one thing. Ernie's writing came in a column. He was not a person writing news dispatches about, you know, the previous day's battles, about how the war was going in a military sense, at least not very often. So he had time to hang out with soldiers, to live with units for sometimes for days and even weeks at a time, and to reflect on what he had seen and to write about it more carefully than the average sort of daily newspaper correspondent had time to write. His style was simple, declarative sentences. What came through was a tremendously sensitive, compassionate sensibility. I think that more than anything else, along with his basic genius as a prose stylist, is what made people respond to him so broadly and so in such a heartfelt way during the war.
You say that he created a new kind of war hero. What do you mean?
Well, before World War II, the kind of classic image of the soldier, of the war hero in America, is probably captured best by Theodore Roosevelt in the charge up San Juan Hill during the Spanish-American War. It's sort of a Victorian image of heroism, of heroic advance against the foe. In Ernie's writings, what we see is a different kind of heroism. It's a heroism of endurance. It's a very different kind of war, obviously. This is industrial warfare, where what most soldiers are doing in battle most of the time is gutting it out, is just surviving against sort of terrible onslaughts of artillery, especially. And so that's what kind of comes through in Ernie's corpus, is the image of a suffering soldier who is enduring against, you know, terrific odds. And so that's really a new kind of admirable quality that he holds up to the American public.
I'd like you to read an excerpt of a column in which he just described what was probably the first war death that he witnessed. Maybe you can give us the context of this column and read an excerpt for us.
This is shortly after Ernie had arrived in North Africa, which is really his first involvement in the American part of the war, late 1942, early 1943. And Ernie had covered aviation before, so he was comfortable with pilots and flyers and flight mechanics. And so one of the first things that he does is go with an Air Corps outfit and hang out at this airfield in Algeria. And so he's describing this scene, and I'll read just a little scene setter and then jump to the some words of his. It was late afternoon at our desert aerodrome. The sun was lazy, the air was warm, and a faint haze of propeller dust hung over the field, giving it softness. We had already seen death that afternoon, for one of the returning fortresses had released a red flare over the field, and I had stood with others beneath the great plane as they handed its dead pilot head downward through the escape hatch onto a stretcher. The faces of his crew were grave, and nobody talked very much. One man clutched a leather cap with blood on it. The pilot's hands were very white. Everybody knew the pilot. He was so young a couple of hours ago. The war came inside us then, and we felt it deeply. Then Ernie describes a group of flying fortresses that had been out on a mission and were coming back. Most of them had made it back to the field. One was still missing. And they wait, really, for several hours, and they give up the plane for lost. And then all of a sudden there's a flare seen on the horizon, and they realize that it's that last fortress coming back to the field, but very slowly. He says, "It seemed almost on the ground, it was so low, and in the first glance we could sense that it was barely moving, barely staying in the air. Crippled and alone, 2 hours behind all the rest, it was dragging itself home. I am a layman, and no longer of the fraternity that flies, but I can feel, and at that moment I felt something close to human love for that faithful, battered machine, that far, dark speck struggling toward us with such pathetic slowness. Thousands of men around that vast field suddenly realized that they were weak and that they could hear their hearts pounding. Our 10 dead men were miraculously back from the grave."
One of the great things about Ernie Pyle's war writing is that it's almost like he's writing letters home to all of America. He's writing in the first person. He's addressing the readers very directly. It's personal in a way that I think is very uncommon for newspaper writing of that period.
That's right. And in fact, Ernie described himself as a letter writer. Even before the war, he said, "That's essentially what I do, is write letters to people." He had developed this style as a traveling columnist before the war, spent 6 years traveling around the country and the whole Western Hemisphere, writing very much in the style that he used during the war. So it was a comfortable way of writing for him. And really the column that we read during the war is one that he'd been already writing for several years.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with James Tobin about his biography of Ernie Pyle, the famous World War II correspondent. His biography is called Ernie Pyle's War, America's Eyewitness to World War II. In today's war in Iraq, embedded journalists are assigned by the military what troop or unit they're going to travel with. How did it work with Ernie Pyle in the military? How did he hook up with the troops that he traveled with? Did he have to get permission from anyone on top before doing it?
Well, you would apply to be a war correspondent, and you would be accredited to one theater or another. As I understand the situation in Iraq now, the embedded reporters are accredited only to one particular unit. It's more restricted than it was during World War II, when the reporters, really many of them, were able to travel around more freely from one unit to another. Ernie pretty quickly established himself as one of the leading reporters, and pretty soon as very much the leader. And so the generals, the military bureaucrats were delighted to have Ernie come with whatever unit he chose to come with. They knew it was great publicity for their outfit. But he would often have a jeep to himself or would travel with a colleague. And really, especially in North Africa early in the war, would really roam around at will. Now, all dispatches from all correspondents were censored, passed through military censors before they were transmitted back to the United States. But after a while, I think it was in most cases very clear to the correspondents what was permissible and what wasn't. Everybody knew the rules. And most of the censorship rules applied simply to military security, as they do now.
This was before satellite phones. How did Ernie Pyle get his columns back to his newspaper?
Mostly by teletype. If he was in Europe, say, if he was in France near the end of the war and the campaign in Normandy, he would go to a press camp and the dispatch would be after being censored, it would be sent by teletype to London and then by transatlantic cable back to New York. So it went through several steps. There were more filters than there are now, for sure.
Ernie Pyle was a columnist, not a news reporter. So, people might wonder, well, how did someone like Ernie Pyle cover an event like D-Day, just like a massive battle like D-Day? And so I thought I'd ask you to read an excerpt of Ernie Pyle's column about D-Day, what he chose to say about that event.
You bet. Ernie came in the day after D-Day, and he's faced with the battle being sort of a mile or so inland. He doesn't want to write about that. He wants to try and capture what had happened on the beach on June 6th. And so what I think is just a brilliant piece of journalistic strategy, he just takes a walk on the beach, walks along, describing what he sees at his feet. And at first he describes some of the materiel and the just the office junk that's there and all kinds of things that are on material things that are on the beach. Then he writes, "But there is another and more human litter. It extends in a thin little line, just like a high water mark, for miles along the beach. This is the strewn personal gear that will never be needed again, of those who fought and died to give us our entrance into Europe. Here in a jumbled row for mile on mile are soldiers' packs. Here are socks and shoe polish, sewing kits, diaries, Bibles, and hand grenades. Here are the latest letters from home, with the address on each one neatly razored out, one of the security precautions enforced before the boys embarked. Here are toothbrushes and razors and snapshots of families back home staring up at you from the sand. Here are pocketbooks, metal mirrors, extra trousers, and bloody abandoned shoes. Here are broken-handled shovels and portable radios smashed almost beyond recognition. I picked up a pocket Bible with a soldier's name in it and put it in my jacket. I carried it half a mile or so and then put it back down on the beach. I don't know why I picked it up or why I put it back down. I stepped over the form of one youngster whom I thought dead. But when I looked down, I saw he was only sleeping. He was very young and very tired. He lay on one elbow, his hand suspended in the air about 6 inches from the ground, and in the palm of his hand he held a large, smooth rock. I stood and looked at him a long time. He seemed in his sleep to hold that rock lovingly, as though it were his last link with a vanishing world.
My guest is James Tobin, author of Ernie Pyle's War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Tobin, and we're talking about his biography of the World War II correspondent Ernie Pyle. I'm always interested in what draws a journalist into war reporting, into risking their life to cover a war. Let's talk about why Ernie Pyle did it. Let's start, first of all, with his childhood. He grew up on a farm, and he wanted out. He wanted an adventurous life, and he knew he wasn't going to have it on the farm. He enlisted in the Army at the end of World War I, but I guess he never... The war ended before he got to see combat.
That's it.
So what kind of adventure, what kind of life did he seek out after the end of World War I, when he got out of the military?
Well, Ernie loved to travel and wanted to see the world, and so found that newspapering offered him probably the best chance of doing that. And quickly made lots of trips, traveled to Asia, traveled to South America, and wound up in Washington and New York as a newspaper writer. He got bogged down in a desk job for a number of years, was managing editor of a now defunct paper called the Washington Daily News, and proposed that he to his editors that he be allowed to just go out on the road and write. There were very few reporters who really were roving reporters, genuinely traveling all the time, but Ernie became one, and in 1935 started this amazing just journey across the country, back and forth, went to every state, went to Alaska, went to Hawaii, went to South America and Central America, and wrote a column that appeared 6 days a week. It's an astonishing amount of work.
And let's talk a little bit about his personal life. He had a troubled marriage. What were some of the problems within the marriage?
Ernie was married to a very bright and interesting woman, Geraldine Siebolds, whom he called Jerry. But it was pretty clear not long after they were married in the 20s that she was deeply troubled, came from a troubled family. She became an alcoholic and a drug abuser and was probably manic depressive. And so... he tried over the years in many different ways to try and snap her out of it, to get her into some kind of therapy. He thought that the travel column would be a way of changing, providing a constant change of scene for her. He thought that might help her, but none of it did help her. And so by the time of Pearl Harbor, they were their marriage was really shattered. Ernie was starting to have extramarital affairs, and decided early in 1942 that they had to split up. And he hoped that maybe by splitting up, it would shock Jerry into sort of a new self-awareness, that she might seek more effective treatment, and that they might be able to remarry, which ultimately did happen. But it's really to escape that real personal trauma and his own depression that Ernie went to war in the beginning. It wasn't so much that he was dying to cover the war, it was that he was dying to just get out of his situation and find a change to escape. And I think that, I don't know how many reporters in Iraq would say something like that, but certainly through the history of war correspondence, there is a tradition of reporters singing war as a way to get out, as a way of sort of personal, to find personal escape and liberation.
You said that Ernie Pyle had depression problems himself. Why did he think that being in the front lines with the soldiers would help him get over his depression?
Well, I don't know if he thought of it in such a one-to-one relationship, but I think he realized once he was in the middle of the war that warfare was profoundly distracting, that it was a way of allowing yourself to be absorbed into something much larger than yourself. That's not to say that he was a warmonger, or that he was desperate to see gory scenes. It's that he was fascinated by the spectacle of it, and I think to some extent it did lift him out of his depression.
Well, he writes about how he found war strangely liberating. Would you read an excerpt of that?
Yes. After going overseas, Ernie spent a number of months in Ireland and England, and then he was able to go along with Operation Torch, the American, the Allied invasion of North Africa. And so he goes really without a clear sense of how long he's going to stay there. He's not really committing himself to being a war correspondent. But as the American forces go into battle and he goes along, he does find himself feeling like he's making a contribution, feeling like the copy that he's writing is good and valuable. And so he was really taken by the whole thing. And part of what he was taken by was just the sort of rugged, outdoor, difficult life that he was in. And he says this about that. "The danger comes in spurts. Discomfort is perpetual. Dirt and cold are almost constant. Outside of food and cigarettes, there are none of the little things that make life normal back home. There are no chairs, lights, floors, or tables. There isn't any place to set anything, or any store to buy things. There are no newspapers, milk, beds, sheets, radiators, beer, ice cream, or hot water. A man just sort of exists, either standing up working or lying down sleeping. There is no pleasant in between. The velvet is all gone from living." But as I say, Pyle also finds this life really exhilarating and liberating. He says, "You don't have appointments to keep. Nobody cares how you look. Red tape is at a minimum. You have no desk, no designated hours. You don't wash your hands before you eat, nor afterwards either. It would be a heaven for small boys with dirty ears."
James Tobin is the author of the book Ernie Pyle's War. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by A&D, presenting the premiere of Napoleon, an original movie starring Isabella Rossellini and John Malkovich, tomorrow at 8 p.m., 7 Central on A&E. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Scorched Earth, a novel of suspense by David L. Robbins, author of War of the Rats. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the public versus the private Ernie Pyle. We continue our conversation with his biographer, James Tobin. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the novel Family History by Danny Shapiro.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with James Tobin. We're talking about his 1997 book, Ernie Pyle's War, a biography of the famous World War II correspondent. Tobin is also the author of the new book, To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers, and The Great Race for Flight. When we left off, we were talking about Pyle's depressions. Tobin says covering the war initially helped liberate Pyle from depression, but that didn't last long.
Well, I think that it helped Ernie feel better for a while. And then as he saw more and more of the war itself became the most depressing thing in his life. I think this is not that I've ever been in the middle of combat or anywhere close to it, but in reading a lot about the experience of war, you find soldiers and reporters saying that after a period of exhilaration and fascination, the more you're exposed to it, the more you become debilitated psychologically and emotionally. And I think that this is what happens to Ernie. As the war goes on, as he goes from North Africa to the campaign in Sicily, which was very difficult, the summer of 1943, and then especially to the Italian campaign, which was even worse the following winter, and then to France, he sees more and more death. He himself is exposed to more and more danger, has a couple of very narrow, close calls, almost dies. And nobody can do that and stay stable. You can't stay in combat, modern combat, for a long period of time and be okay. It causes deep suffering in anybody who is exposed to it long enough.
He writes a little bit about the depression and the suffering he was going through covering the war. And he writes about this not in a column, but in a letter to a friend. And the letter I'm thinking of is something that he wrote after losing a friend in the war.
Early in February 1944, a reporter named Raymond Clapper was killed. He was one of these prominent newspaper columnists and had been a colleague of Ernie's in Scripps Howard. Was mostly known as a Washington correspondent, but went to war and was killed in the South Pacific, and Ernie found out about it. And he writes to his close friend and his editor, Lee Miller. He says, "I'm just floored by it. What a waste of intelligence and character. As the whole war is, it gives me the creeps. The whole thing is getting pretty badly under my skin, Lee. I've got so I brood about it, about the whole thing, I mean. And I have a personal reluctance to die that is always in my mind like a weight. Instead of growing stronger and hard, as good veterans do, I've become weaker and more frightened. I'm all right when I'm actually at the front, but it's when I pull back and start thinking and visualizing that it almost overwhelms me. I've even got so I don't sleep well and have half-awake, hideous dreams about the war."
Is that the kind of sentiment you think he would have confessed to his readers, or does he save those kinds of the vulnerabilities and the doubts and the overwhelming despair that he's feeling, does he save that for letters, for personal letters?
He expressed that more often in letters, but he does express it in his column. There are comparable passages in a number of the columns. I think what he does is ration that sort of feeling and that sort of expression. There was a feeling during the war, and I think that this is pretty true in any democratic society fighting a war. There's a line that correspondents feel they have to walk between realism and encouraging a kind of demoralization among their readers. They worry, as Ernie said in a couple of these passages, that people just won't understand it. And I think that this is the reason that many soldiers, after they come home, are reluctant to say what really happened, even to their loved ones. I think a lot of us have found that our fathers and grandfathers who fought in World War II have taken most of their lives to be able to really say what it was like. And it's only near the end when they want to tell people, this was what I went through. When they're younger, it's really difficult to bridge the gap between the front and the home front.
You write how there was a growing difference between the public Ernie Pyle, the people the public knew through his newspaper columns, and the private Ernie Pyle. What was the difference?
Well, it's certainly true that that Ernie had established a kind of persona in the column that was, you know, universally known and loved. And the persona was of a kind of hapless, carefree, kind of Charlie Chaplin-esque figure. Funny, casual, able to kind of bounce from one thing to another without being terribly troubled. And that was very much not what Ernie was experiencing as the war went on. And so there is a kind of divide between the sort of reassuring, comforting persona of the column, who is telling people, you know, it's bad, but your sons, your brothers, your husbands, they're getting through it okay. They'll be all right. They haven't changed deeply. He wants to reassure on that score. And yet, as you said in his letters, you do see a darker side emerging, where he's not so sure about the suffering that he's seeing around. There's one column where he says, I couldn't find the four freedoms among the dead men. That's about the toughest he ever expressed it in an actual column. More often he's saying that sort of thing in letters. And so he does sort of unburden himself to his wife, to his editor, and to close friends.
Ernie Pyle was also known through his portrayal by Burgess Meredith in the movie The Story of G.I. Joe, a World War II film that was made while the war was still going on. And what was the involvement of the military in this movie?
Well, the movie was really the military's idea. And this is an interesting side of the sort of the movie history of World War II that we all know, that I certainly didn't know until I did the research for the book. Early in the war, it was the Navy and the Air Corps that most movies were made about. Those were seen to be the heroic branches of the armed services, and the glamorous ones and the exciting ones. That's where the real action was. Whereas the infantry was, seen as dull and dirty and slogging and not of, not the sort of thing you would make a movie about. So there were figures in the army in Washington who were looking for somebody, looking for a producer who would make a movie about the army, and they came across this young producer, Lester Cowan, whom they convinced to look into this. Cowan actually talked to this fellow, Raymond Clapper, who said, well, if you want to make a movie about the infantry, you should read the columns of Ernie Pyle. And Cowan then went back and read all of Ernie's columns to date and was very much taken by them, and approached Scripps Howard and Ernie and proposed the idea of a movie that would be based on Ernie's work in the field. And so the story of G.I. Joe, which didn't come out ultimately until 1945, is an interesting kind of hybrid. It comes out of this, essentially a propaganda impulse to give the army its due, to give the infantry its due in Hollywood. But then Ernie was so insistent that it be realistic that the army never really got the kind of heroic tale that it wanted, that it envisioned at the beginning anyway. What it got was a kind of, really kind of a strange movie, an interesting movie, without much of a plot, that is really just more documentary in its feel, and that really does present the new kind of Pyle version of the heroic soldier, dirty, slogging, enduring, not the gallant, rushing over the hilltop kind of soldier.
Some of the film is based on one of Ernie Pyle's most famous columns. Robert Mitchum stars in the film as a very sympathetic captain. And the column that the movie is partially based on is about Captain Henry Wasco. Would you read an excerpt of that column for us and tell us what you think makes this column important?
The column is set in Italy. Ernie was in the mountains with army troops, and particularly with a group that is involved in using mules to bring dead bodies off down from the mountains where the fighting had been going on. It was too difficult and steep for soldiers to bring the bodies down themselves, so they used these mules. So he writes in this column in part, "I was at the foot of the mule trail the night they brought Captain Wasco down. The moon was nearly full at the time, and you could see far up the trail, and even partway across the valley, soldiers made shadows as they walked. Dead men had been coming down the mountain all evening, lashed onto the backs of mules. The first one came early in the morning. I don't know who that one was. You feel small in the presence of dead men and ashamed of being alive, and you don't ask silly questions. Then Pyle explains that several more bodies are brought into this clearing by this cowshed where there are men standing. And one of them is identified as this Captain Wasco. The men in the road seemed reluctant to leave. They stood around, and gradually I could sense them moving, one by one, close to Captain Wasco's body. Not so much to look, I think, as to say something in finality, to him and to themselves. I stood close by, and I could hear. One soldier came and looked down, and he said out loud, "God damn it." That's all he said, and then he walked away. Then another soldier came and bent over, and he too spoke to his dead captain, not in a whisper, but awfully tenderly, and he said, "I sure am sorry, sir." Then the first man squatted down, and he reached down and took the captain's hand, and he sat there for a full 5 minutes, holding the dead hand in his own, and looking intently into the dead face, and he never uttered a sound all the time he sat there. Finally, he put the hand down, he reached up and gently straightened the points of the captain's shirt collar, and then he sort of rearranged the tattered edges of his uniform around the wound. And then he got up and walked away down the road in the moonlight, all alone.
Why do you think that column had the impact that it did?
I think it had an impact chiefly because it's a fine piece of writing. It's extremely descriptive. It really is just a model of what fine documentary journalism ought to be, in just bringing the reader into a scene and seeing something extraordinary. I think the meaning of the column for people, it affected people different ways, but I think that the chief meaning of the column is that it, between the lines, drives home this poignant theme of the comradeship among soldiers. It's not so much about the captain himself, who is hardly described at all in the rest of the column, but it's about the feeling of the men for each other and for the dead man. And so there's this sense of tragedy and loss, but also of, I think there's a certain reassuring theme between the lines of something good coming out of this awful experience of war, that there's a kind of love that exists in war. And that's one of the themes that we see often in fine war writing, that the people will admit to a certain appeal about the experience of war. And that's one of them, is that bond of love among soldiers.
My guest is James Tobin, author of Ernie Pyle's War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Tobin. We're talking about his biography of Ernie Pyle, whose dispatches from World War II gave many Americans their most vivid and lasting descriptions of the war. Ernie Pyle died in the war. How did he die?
Ernie was killed in the Pacific. He went home shortly after the liberation of Paris, late summer of 1944, and spent several months in the U.S. Trying to rest, but really being sort of kind of a public figure, it was difficult, and had more difficult times with his wife, who attempted suicide during that period. And I think he came to feel that he couldn't just stop before the war was over. He had to go back to it, and because he had been in Europe so long, although that was certainly the place he identified with, the people he identified with, he felt that he owed it to the Navy and the Marines in the Pacific to go there. And so that was set up with the Navy. He spent time on an aircraft carrier in the Western Pacific, and then took part in the invasion of Okinawa, and then just in April of 1945, went ashore on a little island that is just off Okinawa called Iwo Jima. And really in just a kind of a, not in the middle of a battle, but in just a random situation, he was crossing the island in a jeep The Jeep was fired upon by a Japanese machine gunner, and Ernie and the other guys jumped out and into a ditch at the side of the road. And when the machine gun was quiet, he raised his head up and was hit in the temple and killed immediately.
Was his body found right away?
His body was recovered only after a few hours. There was still the danger of this machine gun nest, and so finally some guys crawled out, and a photographer took a picture of the body, and some other guys pulled Ernie's body back, and the word already was sent out via radio that Ernie had been killed. And it was an extraordinary event. It was only a few days after President Roosevelt had died, and the headlines about Ernie Pyle's death were almost as large as the headlines about Roosevelt's death.
Now, he had a column that he was in the middle of writing that was discovered in one of his pockets. When he died, he was expecting that there would be victory in Europe any day, and so he was already writing the column about that victory. The column was never published, but you published some of that in your biography of Pyle. I'd like you to read it for us.
This was just it hadn't been typed up yet. It was in Ernie's pocket, just in a handwritten draft, you know, with crossouts and arrows, and this is part of what he wrote. "And so it is over. The catastrophe on one side of the world has run its course. The day that had so long seemed would never come has come at last." And he said he's writing this in waters near Japan. "But my heart is still in Europe. For the companionship of 2.5 years of death and misery is a spouse that tolerates no divorce. In the joyousness of high spirits, it is easy for us to forget the dead. There are so many of the living who have burned into their brains forever the unnatural sight of cold dead men scattered over the hillsides and in the ditches along the high rows of hedge throughout the world. Dead men by mass production, in one country after another, month after month and year after year. Dead men in winter and dead men in summer. Dead men in such familiar promiscuity that they become monotonous. Dead men in such monstrous infinity that you come almost to hate them. Those are the things that you at home need not even try to understand. To you at home, they are columns of figures, or a near one who went away and just didn't come back. You didn't see him lying so grotesque and pasty beside the gravel road in France. We saw him. Saw him by the multiple thousands. That's the difference."
Why do you think Scripps Howard decided not to publish this column that he'd been writing?
I think that gets too close to the way people feel when they've been at war for a long time in the middle of it and have a point of view about it that is simply unacceptable to people who have viewed the war from the home front, from afar. That vision of war is just at odds with the way people at home wanted to feel about the war, which was that it was tragic and that, and of course, many had suffered losses, but not that it was this reality that you couldn't, this dark reality that you just couldn't escape from. And that's what Ernie is talking about. Ernie's talking there about what it really felt like to be at war for a long time. And it was ultimately intolerable.
And he's talking about dead men by mass production.
Right. That's a pretty terrifying image.
How do you think writing this book about Ernie Pyle has influenced how you see the reports now coming out of Iraq?
I think that the policy of embedding the reporters is a real good one, and I hope that the Pentagon sticks with it, and I hope that the correspondents sort of live up to the responsibility that that they have in reporting the war honestly and fairly. I think that there's a naive view that simply by putting a reporter with a military unit that he or she will automatically produce columns like Ernie Pyle produced. You're lucky to get a journalist like Pyle once in a generation, and we'll be lucky to get one reporter like him out of this war. So it's a good thing, but we can't expect all of them to rise to Pyle's standard of achievement.
James Tobin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
James Tobin is the author of the 1997 biography Ernie Pyle's War, which is out in paperback. His new book is called To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers and the Great Race for Flight. Here's a voiceover from the end of the film The Story of G.I. Joe, with Burgess Meredith in the role of Ernie Pyle. The words are taken from Pyle's own writings.
That is our war. And we will carry it with us as we go from one battleground to another until it's all over. We will win. I hope we can rejoice with victory, but humbly. That all together we will try out of the memory of our anguish, to reassemble our broken world into a pattern so firm and so fair that another great war can never again be possible. And for those beneath the wooden crosses, there is nothing we can do except perhaps to pause and murmur, "Thanks, pal. Thanks."
Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews the new novel Family History by Danny Shapiro. This is Fresh Air. Danny Shapiro is the author of a best-selling memoir, Slow Motion, as well as four novels. Her latest novel, Family History, describes the domino effect of disaster on one formerly unremarkable New England family. Book critic Maureen Carrigan says, a high-toned literary melodrama is just what she, and maybe other readers, need right now as a distraction from the anxieties of the real world.
Women's weepies, they were called. Those great three-hanky melodramas of the 1930s and 40s, like Stella Dallas and Mildred Pierce. The plucky heroines of those films had everything thrown at them. Faithless husbands and lovers, ungrateful or sick children, social ostracism, financial ruin, even trumped-up homicide charges. Audiences of the time, female and male, found in these tales of trouble and true grit a cinematic escape valve for the worries generated by the Great Depression and World War II. Maybe that's why, given the high anxieties of our own time, a woman's weepy in book form seems like such an appealing thing to read right now. Danny Shapiro's new novel, Family History, is an elegantly written, wry, and unsettling novel informed by current thinking about adolescent development and dysfunctional family dynamics. I'm not intending to take anything away from the book's intelligence or aesthetic value by saying that ghostly traces of Barbara Stanwyck's trembling but uplifted chin and Joan Crawford's glistening eyes materialize on almost every page of this novel. The heroine of Family History, a 40-ish woman named Rachel Jensen, signals that her story is the stuff that great tearjerkers were once made of when she says this about her unfeeling in-laws. They don't understand that you can do everything right in your life, and still it can go terribly wrong. When the novel opens, those terribly wrong things have already happened to Rachel and her family. She introduces herself to us from the bedroom of her shambling house in quaint Hawthorne, Massachusetts. She spends much of her time in that darkened bedroom, hiding out, dozing, watching home videos of the way life used to be. The way life is now for Rachel is that she hasn't seen her 14-year-old daughter, Kate, for nearly a year. When adolescence struck, Kate inexplicably transformed in one summer from a vivacious tomboy to a sullen, suicidal teenager. These days, she's locked away in what used to be called a reform school. Rachel's 2-year-old son, Josh, is the subject of hushed judgments among the other parents at the Little Acorn Preschool. Josh is oddly silent for a toddler. Brain damage is the word that's whispered. Because of the accident that may or may not have permanently hurt Josh, as well as the awful accusation that spins off from it, Rachel's wonderful husband, Ned, is living apart from her and Josh at a condo complex nicknamed Divorced Dad Dunes. Rachel describes the place this way. At 7 or 8 o'clock at night, if you drive by the complex, you'll see televisions flickering in all the windows. It isn't hard to imagine the sweatpants, the bad takeout Chinese food eaten straight from the carton. Unlucky folks living in a suspended, dazed equilibrium, waiting for their old lives to be over and their new lives to begin. What makes Family History such an absorbing novel is the matter-of-fact yet deeply affecting way it dramatizes how those quirky three sisters of fate just need to give a tiny tug here, a premature snip of the yarn there, to unravel a person's whole world. And that world feels real because Shapiro is such a precise observer of character and of small telling moments. In a scene at Josh's preschool, for instance, Shapiro nails the quick glances of the other mothers that snub and effectively eject Rachel into the Bermuda Triangle of motherhood. I said that weepies, cinematic or literary, are a genre suited to anxious times. Just the other day, my university, itself located in the plausible prime target zone of Washington, D.C., issued a directive suggesting that faculty bring in emergency kit bags of necessary items should we need to be bunkered in with our colleagues for several days in the event of chemical attack. I thought about what that great academic satirist Kingsley Amis would have made out of such a situation. Then, naturally, I began to wonder about what books I would pack. Some classics and mysteries, of course, but also a good weepy, like Family History, in the event I need an excuse for a good cry.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Family History by Danny Shapiro. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Toms of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of the Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or tomsofmaine.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, helping soldiers deal with the stress of war. We talk with retired Army Colonel James Martin. He was a senior social worker in the first Gulf War, counseling soldiers before and after combat. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.